Coming up on Philosophy Talk, new books for your summer reading list.
Am I being nice? Am I being good? Am I caring? Am I trying to be friendly?
How to be perfect, the correct answer to every moral question.
Am I being too selfish? Am I treating other people the way that I would want to be treated?
These are questions that consequentialism and focusing on consequences really can't answer and don't have the resources to answer.
The Good It Promises, The Harm It Does, Critical Essays on Effective Altruism.
This is a band-aid on a system that is bleeding heavily.
So it becomes more politically urgent to hear what lower class people have to say.
Recording Russia, trying to listen in the 19th century.
And it becomes more possible to imagine that the things they have to say can be recorded and circulated.
It's our annual summer reading list.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs.
And I'm Josh Landy. We're coming to you from the studios of KLW San Francisco Bay Area.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where I teach philosophy and Josh directs the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today's episode has been generously sponsored by the Division of Literatures, Cultures, and Languages at Stanford University. It's our annual summer reading list. Thought-provoking books for thoughtful readers.
This year, we've picked out a few new titles that caught our interest, including one that takes a new look at effective altruism, a topic we discussed in an episode last fall.
Later in the show, we'll be joined by Laurie Gruen from Wesleyan University. She's one of the editors of The Good It Promises, The Harm It Does, Critical Essays on Effective Altruism.
We'll also be joined by our Stanford colleague, Gabriella Safran. She's a professor of Slavic languages and literatures and has a new book called Recording Russia, Trying to Listen in the 19th Century, which is all about middle-class writers trying to represent the voice of the people.
And we'll take summer reading suggestions from listeners like you.
But first, let's kick off this year's summer reading list with a little bit of television.
You're okay, Eleanor. You're in the good place.
The Good Place, which aired for four seasons on NBC, followed a group of misfits as they navigated moral questions in the afterlife. It was created by Michael Schur, who consulted a bunch of philosophers, like our friend Pamela Hieronymi from UCLA.
Yeah, one of my favorite moments in the show is when Chidi, the philosophy professor, gets impatient with his students.
I just don't feel like you're engaging with the material, like with the trolley problem.
That was just tricky. That's all. Why don't you just tell me the right answer?
Well, that's what's so great about the trolley problem is that there is no right answer.
This is why everyone hates moral philosophy professors.
I'm on your side here, dude, but he is not wrong.
Yeah, not only does everyone hate moral philosophy professors, they kind of hate moral philosophy, too. And can you blame them? Seems like a quest to be a perfect person would make you miserable.
Oh, well, that has a interesting aftertaste. Is that from a nearby river?
Oh, no. Why take fresh water away from the beavers and the fish? No, I have my composting toilet hooked up to a water filtration system. One man's waste is another man's water. And both men are me.
The Good Place wrapped in 2020, but its creator had enough of the philosophy bug to write a book called How to Be Perfect, The Correct Answer to Every Moral Question, and to join us on today's program to talk about it. Michael Schur, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So, Michael, in this book, you tell us you love philosophy, you love Beckett, you love Woody Allen, but you kind of feel bad about it. You love single malt whiskey. You hate the Yankees. You think Heidegger's a fascist. You have a bad sense of direction. You think running is awful. No one should ever do it unless they're being chased by a bear. My question to you is, are you my long-lost twin?
Oh, I'm glad to hear that I have a soulmate, and that, I mean, that list you just made, like, that's a good person. If you want to know what a good person is, it's someone who inhabits that list of characteristics.
So
you
thank
just
you.
Out.
Wait. I lose points for liking running.
Correct. That is absolutely correct. Yes, you're a bad person.
So this kind of brings me into another question. I kind of identify with Chidi in The Good Place, where I would really like to be a good person, but I kind of get paralyzed. There are so many choices I have to make every day. There seem like so many possible ways for me to choose wrong. What am I supposed to do?
Great question. I think that most philosophers that I have met fall into the general category of Chidi. Like, what are the things that you're doing when you write a television show? Is you're trying to create characters that folks can identify with, right? That's a pretty basic idea. And I've never had any group of people more directly relate to and identify with a character than professional academics and philosophers in particular, and Chidi Anagonye. So you're not alone. And I would also say, by the way, that I identify with him too. It's part of why this subject matter became so interesting to me and so important to me, is that as I found that the more I cared about the world that I lived in and the more I cared about other people, the more impossible my life started to seem, because when you decide that all of the things you do mean something and matter, then you start questioning all of the choices you're making. And there is a ignorance is bliss thing that you leave behind, right? And as soon as you learn about global warming or climate change, you start thinking, like, it gets all the way down to the microcosmic level of, well, should I buy this pair of socks or not? And it can be maddening. And so, you know, I think the show and to a large extent the book was making the argument that the important thing is that you care one way or the other whether you're a good person, and that you try wherever you can to be a good person. That to me is actually more important than the sort of impossible to answer question of, am I actually achieving that? Am I a good person? Because the attempt at virtue to me is the thing that is that matters the most.
So I was going to ask whether it was a mistake for me to have taken my first philosophy class, because it would be so much easier if I hadn't done that. So why is this agonizing good and important?
Well, I mean, this is sort of a reductive argument, I suppose, but like, what's the option? Not caring at all? You know, I got to a point in my life where I thought, in the moments where I was like, God, it's so irritating to have to care about this stuff, to have to care about every consumer choice you make and every friendship choice you make and every parenting choice you make, with this extra added level of like, is this virtuous? Is this, you know, deontologically correct? Whatever your methodology is. As annoying as that is, it just occurred to me at some point, like, well, the option is that you don't care. And I just can't believe that the right answer in terms of how to live our lives on earth is to not care one way or the other whether the things you're doing are good. So, look, it's annoying. I get it. I mean, that's what a lot of the book is about, is how annoying it is to care about this stuff and how much of a pain in the butt you are to your friends and family members and everyone around you. But I think it's a far better outcome for an average life on earth to care and be a little bit annoying about it than to not care at all. I just can't see how that's the right answer.
Yeah, and one thing I love about this book, How to Be Perfect, that you take all these theories, deontology, consequentialism, virtue ethics, contractualism, Buddhism, you also talk about Ubuntu, and you kind of boil them down, I think, very helpfully to a set of heuristics. So, you know, ask yourself, would it be okay if everyone did this? Ask yourself, how many people will be happier or sadder as a result of me doing this rather than that? Am I being a good kind of person? I mean, those seem like very, you know, on the one hand, you could say, yes, they're fairly simple guidelines. On the other hand, they're kind of powerful.
I think so, too. And I think that the expressed goal of the book was to say, look, I don't understand this stuff nearly as well as folks who have studied it their whole lives or who specialize in it. But I think I understand them well enough to be able to relate their central ideas. And that became the project of the book, really, was to say, like, hey, I think there's a lot of people out there who would hear words like deontological reasoning or consequentialism or whatever and think like, well, I don't understand that. There's no chance that I could ever relate to those ideas or those issues. And the point of the book was to say, like, no, the words, they have a lot of letters in them and they have a lot of syllables, but the ideas contained in these theories are pretty straightforward. Like, I'll tell you, I did, when during COVID, my son was in sixth grade and we were desperate for things for him and his classmates to do that weren't, you know, look at TikTok. And my wife suggested, a lot of the kids were watching the show, were watching The Good Place. And my wife said, you know, why don't you do like a little fun, like, seminar about the show and about philosophy? Because you've been, you know, reading about it and studying it and working on it for so long. And I was a little skeptical. But we got about 30 kids together on a Zoom once a week, and I would give them a couple episodes of the show to watch that were centered around one or the other of the philosophers I talk about in the book. And then We would get on the Zoom. We would talk about the episodes. I would relate to them the philosophy that we were discussing. And the kids were totally engaged and involved and asked really smart questions. And I was like, man, you know, if sixth grade students, bright students, but sixth grade students can, you know, interact with these ideas and press me on the details of them and seemingly understand them and get something out of them, well, that's a good sign, because that means that at their heart, these ideas are things that anybody in the world who cares to understand them can understand.
So do you have a favorite of these ideas that you want to lay on us now?
My favorite of them that I stumbled into was contractualism, I have to say. Contractualism is like this really pragmatic view of the world, which is we share the world with other people. We cannot function without the cooperation and the understanding of other people. And in order to sort of lay out the rules by which we will all live, we need other people to agree to them. And that's annoying, because other people are frequently very annoying. And it seems like a little bit of a pipe dream. It seems like a little bit of a fantasy land. But the way that it's laid out in Scanlon's book, What We Owe to Each Other, is sort of like, let's get down in the muck. Let's get down in the dirt and really like hammer this thing out. And it's not going to result in a perfect utopian society where everybody's holding hands. In fact, far from it. It's going to result in a sort of bare minimum baseline of understanding of the rules we all agree to. I really found there to be something sort of beautiful in that idea, honestly. It really sort of moved me to think that that would be the way that we would go about making rules. I don't consider myself necessarily a contractualist. I think if I personally have any one philosophy that I adhere to, it's closer to Aristotelian virtue ethics. I think that
I knew it. Yeah. Okay, but you always got a soft spot for virtue ethics.
Yeah, I do. I find it, and I write about this in the book a little bit, but I find virtue ethics to be the most forgiving of all of the philosophies, because built into virtue ethics is this idea that we're going to sort of make mistakes all the time. We're going to blow it. We're going to try to do something we think is the right thing to do, and we're going to fail. And what it asks of us is no more than a sort of self-examination and a debrief and a sort of understanding of, I was a little bit too much this way, or I wasn't quite courageous enough in that moment, or I was a little too angry in that moment. It's pretty close to what a person who has no experience with philosophy at all would do if that person were trying to become a better person. It's really just a sort of ongoing, endless process of honing and pruning the hedges and trying to get everything at the right level, at the right balance. So I think I tend to live my life a little more like that, but the philosophy that sort of lit a fire in my brain the most probably was contractualism.
That's one of the things I like about your book, How to Be Perfect, that it's not afraid to get into difficult philosophical and moral territory. And one of the things I particularly resonated with in that regard is the chapter about great art by bad people, which is a really, really difficult topic. And I'm so grateful to you for getting stuck in there. I mean, it reminds me of that documentary Kamau Bell made, We Need to Talk About Cosby, where Cosby meant and something really important to people. And so on the one hand, you have to let it go in a certain sense, or you have to change your attitude. Certainly you have to change your attitude towards the person, but you can't just pretend that that didn't mean anything to you.
Right. How many stand-up comedians became stand-up comedians because they heard the album himself when they were 7 years old or whatever? Like, you can't go back in time and undo that. But the problem is if you pretend that the second part of it doesn't exist, the part of it where you now know that this person in Bill Cosby's case did utterly horrifying things to hundreds of women over decades of his life, well, now you're just saying that there are no consequences for bad behavior, that people, if they're talented enough, can get away with whatever they want to get away with. That's not any kind of society that anyone wants to live in either. So the best you can do is kind of remember both of these things at the same time, all the time. And the reason I think it's hard to do that and that people don't want to do it is because you to makes it impossible to go back and experience that person's art in the same way that you did when it was meaningful to you, right? You can't, there's no pure interaction with that art anymore. And the answer to that is, well, tough. Too bad. Like, that's the deal. You can't unlearn things about people. You can't ignore them. And you're right. That person has spoiled your feeling toward their art to some degree. And that's the best we can do. Unless you are completely just living under a rock, like, we all have these people, right? We all have musicians and artists and painters and you know, symphony orchestra conductors. I mean, there is no aspect of the sort of cultural tapestry that has not been deeply affected by this, and more so recently than at any time in history. So this is a thing we all have to grapple with, we all have to deal with, and I don't really see another way around it.
So, Michael, what is the correct answer to every moral question?
As a kid who really loved the book The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, I'm tempted just to say the correct answer is 42.
Wait, this too? I'm sorry, you really are my long-lost twin.
I really hope Douglas Adams didn't do anything awful so I can think of that book fondly. There is no answer to every moral question. The closest, again, that I think you can come is the answer is you got to care about whether or not you're coming up with the right answer. And as long as you care, as long as you're trying, that is sort of all that can be asked of any of us on this mortal plane.
Michael, thank you for the wonderful book and the wonderful conversation and for The Good Place. I still love Chidi so much.
I'm glad to hear it. Thanks for having me.
Michael Schur, creator of TV's The Good Place and author of How to Be Perfect, the correct answer to every moral question. You're listening to Philosophy Talk, and today we're putting together our annual summer reading list.
Coming up, we'll check on how things are going for effective altruists, and we'll discuss listening in 19th century Russia.
Thought-provoking reading for your summer evenings, when Philosophy Talk continues. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's our annual summer reading show, generously sponsored by the Division of Literatures, Cultures, and Languages at Stanford University. I'm Josh Landy, here with my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs.
Last fall, we produced an episode exploring effective altruism, a moral theory about doing the most good you can. Our guest was pretty enthusiastic about it, but if you've been following some of the news over the last years, you could be forgiven for giving it a second look.
Which is why we were pleased to see the publication this spring of The Good It Promises, The Harm It Does, Critical Essays on Effective Altruism. It was co-edited by an old friend of the show, Wesleyan University philosopher Laurie Gruen. We asked her to start by telling us what exactly effective altruism is.
Well, in a very short set of clauses, I can tell you that effective altruism is a view that we should use reason and empirical studies to try to determine the best way to direct our charitable giving.
That sounds like a great idea, but your new book says maybe it's not as good as it sounds. So what's the catch?
Yeah. So the book that I co-edited with Carol Adams and Alice Crary called The Good It Promises, The Harm It Does, really tries to reframe this very clear view that says, look, we have a huge number of problems in the world that humans are causing. And the nice thing about effective altruism is it provides us with this very clear and seemingly obvious way of measuring how to do good in the world. And in this volume, we say, not so much. We are worried about a variety of different things that go wrong with this top-down approach to doing good in the world.
So one thing that came up fairly recently in this context is the scandal around Sam Bankman-Fried, who's arguably become the most famous effective altruist, not for great reasons, right? He was charged with wire fraud, securities fraud, money laundering. What's the worry there? I mean, is that just a kind of a coincidence? He happened to be an effective altruist? Or is there a kind of worry about whether, if you're all in on effective altruism, you might think to yourself, well, a little bit of, you know, bending the rules may be okay in the service of making money for charity?
Exactly right. And as we were putting the final touches on the book as it was going to production, that all blew up. And we thought, right, this is really a timely conversation to be having. Of course, when you have a simple view that the ends justify the means, we know that we end up with some people, and Sam Bankman-Fried is a good example, who really push the envelope under the guise of getting as much money as possible. He planned to give it all away, at least that's what he said. And he is somebody who was motivated to do exactly what he did by his commitments to effective altruism. Now, I'm not saying that if all effective altruists endorse what he did, of course, but it is one thing that's not unpredictable in a extreme utilitarian view of how to get as much money as you can to give them as much money away as you can.
So I want to unpack this a little, because I agree that Sam Bankman-Fried is a problem, and that thinking like any way of funneling money to your favorite charitable causes like is justified, thinking that any way of doing that is justified is also a problem. But you can imagine a sort of more restricted version of effective altruism, where there are certain rules you have to follow, but within the, like, you can't embezzle money, but within those rules you should give as effectively as possible. So why not just sort of step back to effective altruism, but within rules?
Yes. I mean, obviously, we asked the contributors to this volume to tell us what their experiences have been with effective altruists prior to the Sam Bankman-Fried uproar. And so the criticisms that we make collectively, and they're quite variable in the volume, are very much distinct from this more extreme point of view. If you're following rules that allow you to sort of stay within, let's say, the law in raising money, there's nonetheless some serious problems that arise with effective altruism. One of the problems that arises is that there is an understanding that somehow you can measure effectiveness. And this really limits, in many ways, the kind of efforts that one might support through their charitable giving. So, for example, we have a number of contributors to the volume who work in animal sanctuaries. Animal sanctuaries are places where animals who have been used and abused in industrial systems go to live a dignified life, to develop relationships with others, and to be cared for. The effective altruists say this is not effective at all. This is a waste of money.
Well, what's their argument for that? It seems really strange that they would claim it doesn't do any good.
You can't measure the effectiveness that you're doing by saving and caring for animals. It's much more effective, for example, at one point they believed, to devote energy towards building cage-free animal production. So getting rid of cages in animal production will minusculely improve the well-being of animals that are used in the system. But because there's billions of animals used in the system, that very small marginal improvement in their well-being added together becomes, in their view, a very large improvement. So one way to think about the difference is that effective altruists are happy to keep the systems in place if there's improvements that can be measured. And that does seem at odds with the kind of critique that we want to start with, which really is about the structure of these systems and whether we need really kind of a more radical change.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that's been the most powerful criticism that I've come across of effective altruism, that it's basically, you know, the biggest Band-Aid in human history.
right.
And I mean, the same goes presumably not just in the world of factory farming, but also in the world of hedge funds and, you know, crypto world and investment banking, because a lot of these folks, in order to maximize their revenues so that they can give away the most, go into these highly lucrative professions. But that means, of course, keeping those structures very much intact. Is that something that your volume also brings up, you know, that they don't tackle those structures? They don't tackle the structures
exactly
of our current mode of extractive capitalism?
Exactly. This is a band-aid on a system that is bleeding heavily. The extractive capitalism that we're aware of is really causing such problems, so much harm, so much dignity violations, so much injury, so much environmental damage, that it's really these structures that we really need to address. And in my chapter in the volume, I actually draw on some work from one of the early humanitarians, Gus Speth, who has also been arguing along these lines after working for 40 years in the humanitarian aid system, saying, wait a minute, we need some radical shift in how we're thinking about how we might be able to fundamentally improve the lives of those who have been on the, let's say, receiving end of extraction, those who have, whose labor, whose land has been taken from them, and the value of that invested elsewhere. And I think these are old debates that have happened between what you might call revolution and reform. I think that to a large extent, what the effective altruists are doing is moving chairs around on a giant sinking vessel, whereas what we really need is to rethink the system altogether if we have any hope of allowing our children and grandchildren a livable future.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's our annual summer reading special, and we're talking to Laurie Gruen from Wesleyan University, co-editor of The Good It Promises, The Harm It Does, Critical Essays on Effective Altruism.
One way of thinking about the objection that you were just explaining is to think that what we need to do is to like bring about better consequences for the world, but like effective altruism just doesn't give us the tools for measuring those consequences because the tools are kind of embedded in the same systems that are causing a bunch of harm. But I think not all of the essays in your volume think of things that way. Like, maybe ethics isn't about bringing about the best consequences at all. Like, what are some other perspectives on, like, what I'm supposed to be doing?
Good. That's that is really one of the central questions. And for too long, ethical issues seem to be phrased in terms of, well, what consequences or what good consequences can you bring about? How to maximize or satisfy those consequences, how to do something where we're making one state of affairs better vis-a-vis the consequences. And for many of the contributors in the volume, that's the wrong question to be asking. And if we think about the social and political relationships that we're in, we're often going to be asking questions about justice. We're going to be asking questions about friendship, interspecies friendship. Even we're going to be asking questions about dignity and dignity violations. What do people deserve? What do I owe people? These are questions that just focusing on consequences really can't answer and don't have the resources to answer. These other fundamental value questions that I think are central not only to the lives that we live, but also to our social reality. There are a variety of different kinds of values that really do not just motivate people, but provide meaning in their work and their lives. And I think that consequentialism and focusing on consequences really ignores these important values.
But could we salvage anything from effective altruism? I mean, I know someone, for example, who came very close to giving away a kidney. He was at the, just sort of, denied at the last minute for medical reasons. But he wanted to give a kidney away to a stranger, and he would have done so. And he was motivated by reading Peter Singer and by various strands of effective altruism. So is there some good in it? And could we preserve that good while still warding off the damage?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting space for having a conversation like that. And some of the contributors in our volume are arguing in those ways. They think that, yes, sure, some version of effective altruism may be a really useful one. Maybe when you're thinking about motivation, many people are motivated in a variety of ways. And so one thing you might imagine is that some people are motivated by a kind of consequential exchange. And if you're motivated in that way, these kinds of arguments would be useful. And some of the folks in our volume argue that, for example, one way that the effective altruist might be able to do a lot of good and bring about good consequences, but that escapes usually their purview is by focusing on really important changes in Black communities and other communities that don't have access to all sorts of resources that many others do in our own country or in other sort of fairly wealthy places. It's a lot easier if you're doing it effective altruism in its more abstract, more popular way to think, oh, well, I can use this dollar to buy a whole lot more resources for poor people in poor countries than in my own country, for example. So I'm going to not focus on, you know, underprivileged neighborhoods in San Francisco or Washington, D.C. or Baltimore or New York. I'm going to focus on poor communities in India or in Africa because my dollar can do more good there. And you could see already you're starting to really support a kind of system that already is predisposed to injure and ignore and overlook many, many people.
One thing that kind of strikes me about the change between where effective altruism started out and some of the like problems that you've been pointing out is that a lot of effective altruism, I think, started out from critiques of like ineffective charities that were good critiques, where like there's this correct observation that a lot of like charitable giving is more about making the person give money feel good than it is about helping anybody. And I wonder if you think that there's something to that insight that could also be preserved.
So I think that there's important ways of thinking. Okay, so one of the issues that gets a little bit confused in my view in these discussions about charitable giving have to do with the metrics that you measure how effective the charitable giving is. Now, effective altruists have a very specific way of understanding what those metrics should look like. You should do the most good that you can with the capital or the money that you have. And that, I think, is quite different from some other critiques that came about, which are, wait, if this particular charity or organization is saying they're going to do good, but they're spending most of their money on salaries or not really doing the work that they said they were going to do, maybe that charity should be interrogated. I also think, though, and I really want to bring this up because it comes out in my chapter as well, there's a whole nother way of thinking about, if you will, the sort of giving ecosystem. And one is to think about it in terms of solidarity or mutual aid, as opposed to charity, where I have all this money and I'm going to raise all this money so that I can, from on high, give this money to someone else, rather than to imagine that we're in this kind of ecosystem, and there are these new solidarity economies developing, even in the arts world, that I think provide us with a different way of understanding what our social relationships should look like. They're not just these exchanges, efficient exchanges, but rather together we can build something meaningful and transformative.
Laurie, I want to ask one last question about the potential harms of effective altruism, which comes up quite a bit, which is their long-termism. If I understand correctly, many effective altruists these days are thinking about the very distant future, again, because of their commitments to utilitarianism. If you sort of multiply up all of the moments of happiness of all of the human beings who will ever exist, then it starts to look like the long-term health of the human species outweighs a lot of current concerns. But if you go too far down that route, it seems like you could land in some trouble. Is that kind of trouble something that your volume brings up too?
Well, it's right. So long-termism is something that we touch on at the very end. It became much, much more popular in the last year when one of the founders of Effective Altruism released a book. And there was quite a publicity campaign funded by Sam Bankman-Fried, as it turns out. And the idea is really exactly as you say, that there is a sense, and this goes back to philosopher Derek Parfit's insights, that ultimately, if the human population is going to grow massively, and the theory is that it will when we colonize space, another whole set of issues, that we ought to be focusing our current attention on these future people because there's going to be so many more of them. Now, even Peter Singer, you know, another founder of Effective Altruists, is quite skeptical about this particular kind of consequentialist trade-off, because it would actually mean that we might allow a lot of harm and suffering now for some imagined future pleasures or good that might arise in the future. And I think that there's just too many, I mean, I think from his point of view, and I think from many people's point of view, there's just too much uncertainty about being able to actually determine what kind of existential risks are worth avoiding in some distant future. And so I think that is, long-termism is in some ways a really controversial version of effective altruism.
Laurie, it's a fascinating book, and this was an equally fascinating conversation. Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me and talking about these really tricky issues.
Laurie Gruen from Wesleyan University, one of the editors of The Good It Promises, The Harm It Does, Critical Essays on Effective Altruism. You're listening to Philosophy Talk, and today we're compiling our annual summer reading list.
Coming up, summer reading suggestions from listeners, plus writers trying to capture the voices of regular people before they could be recorded.
More summer reading when Philosophy Talk continues. Welcome back. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Today, it's our annual summer reading episode. Thought-provoking books for thoughtful summer reading.
Let's hear from a listener who wrote in with a suggestion. George in San Francisco, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Morning.
So you've got a book to recommend for us. Can you tell us about that book?
That book is Victory City, the most recent novel by Salman Rushdie.
And what happens in this novel?
It's set between the 14th and 16th centuries in southern India. It's a fairy tale, so a lot of supernatural occurrences occur. There are goddesses and kind of driving the narrative. A young woman, a child really, is her tribe is defeated in battle. All the men have died, and the women in mass walk into a fire in a collective act of self-immolation. The goddess witnesses this, one of the local goddesses there, and imbues this child with, possesses the child in a way, so that she later drives the events of the story. And there's a framing story in which the narrator is actually recovering a text that has been buried for centuries that had been originally composed by the central protagonist, who is this woman who, twice a queen, long time in exile, lives through those centuries. She lives, I think, 247 years and receives this boon of this very long life, which is contains its own negation, you might say, in the sense that it's great to live a long life. Not only does she live a very long life, but she's young through much of it. And she remains young and beautiful through a lot of her 247 years. Of course, the drawback is that she sees all the people she loves age and die, including, importantly, her three daughters.
So could you tell us why our Philosophy Talk listeners would be particularly interested in it? What's philosophical about this novel?
There's something maybe anachronistic. I can't say whether the themes of female empowerment and religious pluralism, which are all Rushdie, are anachronistic to a story that very much plays out like a epic antique kind of tale. There's those things. There's the nature of kingship and queenship. And
I would definitely say that I don't think religious pluralism is anachronistic. Like, that's an old theme.
Well, that's just the question, because there's a great deal of allegory embedded in the story. So you got your magic and you got your realism, right?
It's Rushdie. So George, if you had to give people 20-second pitch on why they have to rush out and buy Victory City by Salman Rushdie and read it for over the summer, what would you say? What would be your 20-second sales pitch for it?
It's just a ripping good yarn. It's a fantastic fairy tale told by a master storyteller at the height of his abilities and powers. There's not a dull paragraph in it, but it's very erudite and you really makes you think about a lot of things.
George, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk's annual summer reading special. Now, if you're a middle-class writer who wants to give a voice to the voiceless, how do you do it? Written language is kind of a minefield.
Well, that's something Gabriela Safran has been thinking about. She's professor of Slavic languages and literatures at Stanford University. Her new book is called Recording Russia, Trying to Listen in the 19th Century. Gabriela, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
Gabriela, your book, Recording Russia, it's all about mid-19th century Russian writers trying to capture the voice of the people. So what was that about?
You know, it was about the sense that intellectuals, that what we can call elites, began to have in the mid-19th century, that there's a lot of other people out there that they hadn't been listening to, but maybe they need to listen to them.
Right. So why did this become such a concern in the 19th century?
I mean, I think partly for political reasons, because this is, you know, the time when we're nearing the end of chattel slavery. Serfdom is going to be abolished in the 1860s. It's also a time when there's a kind of media boom. So it becomes more politically urgent to hear what lower class people have to say, and it becomes more possible to imagine that the things they have to say can be recorded and circulated.
I think that's a really interesting question you raise in your book, this question of whether it can make a political difference, like how people write their novels, for example, right? Victor Hugo, in around the same period in France, said, j'ai mis un bonnet rouge au vieux dictionnaire. I put a revolutionary hat on the dictionary. And so some people seem to have that belief that you could actually change the world by changing your language. So are these writers over-optimistic in the power of various sort of formal choices in writing to make a difference in the world? Or did, in fact, these books make a difference?
I mean, I think that these writers had a sense that they could reach people who were able to make important decisions. And that was correct. You know, the writers that I look at, the sort of mid-19th century Russian writers, tended to be themselves imperial administrators. They worked for the Tsarist government in one way or another. They were bureaucrats as well as writers, or they knew bureaucrats. And they knew that their writing could really reach people who could make changes. I think the biggest, the most famous kind of story of a change being made because of writing is Ivan Turgenev wrote a set of stories, Notes of a Hunter, about traveling through the countryside, meeting serfs and talking to them. And the stories demonstrate the serfs are real people. They should be free. It's terrible that they are effectively enslaved and serfed. And some of those stories, folklore says some of those stories were read by Alexander II and prompted him to push for the elimination of serfdom.
Wow, that's a pretty incredible impact to have. But I think, like, one worry I would have if I were doing this is, like, making the right impact. So ending serfdom seems like a good call. But how do you make sure that you're listening to the right voices? Like, how do you get the right information out of people?
That's really what my book is about. How do you do this thing, listening to and recording across social lines? And what interests me is that the writers I look at, understand that there are so many ways they could do this wrong. They grasp that, you know, maybe you're going to listen to serfs or peasants who are not representative, whose stories don't matter. Maybe they're not going to tell you the truth. Maybe you're going to use language wrong. in recording what they say. Either you'll make them sound too folky or not folky enough, and both of those would be bad.
Yeah, and your book, Recording Russia, also presents some of these debates as precursors of conversations that we're having today about similar things. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, there's ways in which I think the debates that my writers are having are, they kind of anticipate some of the debates people have today about cultural appropriation or whether wokeness is performative. I think my writers, these mid-19th century Russian writers, are quite sophisticated thinkers about the question of whether a person from one class or social group has a right to tell and profit from the stories of someone in another social group. And they're also very sophisticated thinkers about the question of when a person, an elite person, might be sort of talking about, showing how they are recording and listening to and recording the voice of the people in a way that's really performative, that's meant to get attention, that's a kind of virtue signaling.
You know, another thing that your book reminded me of in the contemporary context is those endless New York Times stories where a journalist talks to so-called regular folks in rural diners, you know, the people who think climate change is a hoax, or Obama is a Muslim, or, you know, vaccines are going to kill you. And it just cements the notion that real Americans look a certain way. And I wonder if there's something similar, there are similar worries in mid-19th century Russia that, you know, these writers are going out and talking to people whose voices hadn't been maybe represented enough before. But, you know, are there worries about selection? You know, do people keep going to sort of the same towns and talking to the same kinds of people and not really including the great diversity of voices around Russia? Is that a worry in the mid-19th century?
Yeah. Let me, you know, I feel like you've said two things I want to answer. One is, you know, are these writers trying to look good or are they creating change? I think we can't really make that bifurcation. I think one can be trying to look good and really creating change at the same time. Right. And we lead ourselves astray if we think it's either one or the other. Then the question of who are the real people? Absolutely. They argue about this constantly. And they argue really along the same lines as we do. You know, there's on the one hand a sense of the real people, in quotation marks, are rural agricultural workers far away from the capitals. And then there's other people saying, wait, maybe urban workers are just as real.
Exactly.
Definitely a debate that happens in the mid-19th century, using very similar language and ideas to what we would recognize today.
And do you have people sort of selectively amplifying voices in ways that kind of echo their own political sensibilities, saying, oh, the people happen to think what I think? Like, is that a thing that happened in 19th century Russia as well as now?
Yeah, you have people who are upset that other writers' stories about the countryside amplify the voices of women who are beaten by their husbands. If you write a story that amplifies that, then you suggest that there's kind of something wrong with this Russian peasant culture that you're describing, and that might fit with your own maybe proto-feminist views, and that feminism was an important part of Russian kind of intellectual culture in the mid-19th century. But, you know, other people might say to you, don't amplify those voices, amplify some other voices. The countryside is, you know, a beautiful place and peasant culture is beautiful. And why draw so much attention to these women? Okay, maybe sometimes women are beaten by their husbands, but let's not draw so much attention to it.
Oof. So I guess this raises a kind of big philosophical question for me about whether the people can be said to have a voice. Like, if you have like a peasant woman and her husband who is beating her, each of those people has a point of view. Is there like a thing that is the point of view of all the peasants that incorporates both of those?
Yeah, I mean, that's really, that was the question that haunted me throughout writing this book. You know, I feel that my instinct is, of course not. Of course there's no voice of the people. Of course there are only voices of individuals. And I think that a lot of the kind of competition among the writers I look at, each one trying to be better than the others at listening to and recording the voice of the people, I think a lot of that competition stemmed from an anxiety that came from their recognition, their sense that maybe there was no voice of the people and no one could really record it correctly. And maybe we have to just wait for, you know, individual people of peasant origin, which is something that did happen in the 1870s and 80s. Individual people, individual peasants started to say, well, this is my story. This is my story. You know, individuals can speak for themselves, maybe better than for a group. So that's my instinct. At the same time, I grasp that maybe my instinct is a kind of classically, you know, more liberal one. And I am nervous about the idea of collective voices. And maybe there's times and places in which such feeling that there is someone speaking for a people, maybe sometimes that's appropriate or necessary. But I have a kind of rejection of that, instinctive rejection.
Well, this has been a lovely and wonderful, inspiring conversation. Thank you so much, Gabriella, for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Our Stanford colleague, Gabriella Safran, author of Recording Russia, Trying to Listen in the 19th Century.
You can find all the books we've talked about on today's show, along with other recommendations from our listeners, over at our website, philosophytalk.org.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW Local Public Radio's San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2023.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Jamie Lee, Elizabeth Zhu, Emily Wang, Merle Kessler, and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from subscribers at our online community of thinkers. Support for this episode comes from the Stanford Division of Literatures, Cultures, and Languages.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and spend the summer swimming in our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.